This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell endorsed a bipartisan effort this week to clarify how presidential elections are certified. That's after former President Donald Trump and his supporters tried to pressure then-Vice President Mike Pence to throw out legitimate election results from some states after the 2020 election. Their argument centered on the Electoral Count Act, a law that's more than a century old that's supposed to tell Congress and the vice president what to do if there's a dispute about a state's electors. But some lawmakers and political watchers have said, as it's written, the law's language confuses more than it clarifies. David Cannon is a professor of American politics at UW-Madison. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with a listen to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor. This is Tuesday, talking about this Electoral Count Act.
Congress process for counting the presidential electors' votes was written 135 years ago. The chaos that came to a head on January 6th of last year certainly underscored the need for an update.
David, can you talk about how the Electoral Count Act came up around January 6th in particular?
Well, yes. So what McConnell is talking about is the ambiguity in that law that was written in 1887 that allowed, for example, Donald Trump to pressure Mike Pence to exercise discretion over the slates of electors from different states. And Mike Pence had to tell the president, you know, sorry, my understanding of this law and the Constitution is that I can't play that role. But there was enough ambiguity both in the vice president's role and in how the whole process happens of challenging those slates of electors that Senator McConnell is definitely right. This law is in desperate need of an update.
Right. The general understanding was we don't go through the whole election, certify electors, send them to Congress, and then, oh, yeah, the sitting vice president can just reject them. Customarily, everybody, I think, agreed on that until it became an issue at the beginning of 2021, right?
Right, exactly. And so what this law would do, so the Manchin-Collins bill that went through the Senate Rules Committee earlier this week by a 14-to-1 vote. It was surprising the degree of bipartisanship. Ted Cruz is the only person on the committee that voted against it. So it looks like this will have enough votes to easily overcome a filibuster in the Senate. So there's a really good chance that this will be enacted into law. And what the law would do is three or four really important things to make sure that January 6th couldn't happen again. First is to recognize that the vice president only has a ceremonial role here. He has no substantive control over the process at all. He's basically just opening the ballots and counting the votes. Second is to raise the threshold for how those slates of electors from states can be challenged. Under that, the current law, the 1887 law, it just takes one House member and one senator to challenge a slate of electors. That's it. And so the Senate version of this law would increase that threshold to 20% of both the House and the Senate. So 20 senators and it'd be 87 House members would be needed to ask for a challenge to a slate of electors. And it clarifies how that challenge could be justified. Under the current law, it's a failed election that isn't defined. And so Trump supporters were saying that the 2020 election in Wisconsin, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Georgia were failed elections because there was widespread voter fraud that meant that these slates of electors weren't legitimate. Well, those claims were thrown out by the courts and were never proven, but that was the basis for their claim of a failed election. Now the Senate version and the House version is even stronger language on this, but basically defines it as an extraordinary or catastrophic event, something that prevents the election from happening, like, say, Hurricane Ian hitting on Election Day and half the state of Florida not being able to vote on Election Day. That would mean that any slate of electors submitted from Florida could be challenged because that's pretty clearly a failed election in Florida. And then finally, having a more expedited and clear process for challenging any dispute about slates of electors and making clear that the candidate who would be, you know, having his slate or her slate of electors denied has a right to sue in federal court about this, and also ensuring that courts could review whether a rogue governor has kind of gone off and done his own thing and submitted a slate that wasn't legitimate, and that now could be reviewed by the courts as well. So it really closes a lot of the loopholes in that existing law and makes it, you know, if not impossible, much more difficult for something like was attempted on January 6th to ever happen in the future.
Now, you mentioned there was a U.S. House version. It passed, but with much more limited Republican support. The standards are a little different. I think one-third of the House and Senate, a bigger percentage, would have to object, for example. But the Senate version seems to have, as you said, bipartisan support. Is part of the story here, like, yeah, last time it was Republican Mike Pence in that seat. Next time it's going to be Democrat Kamala Harris. Like, this could go either way, so maybe both parties are willing to sign on.
Yeah, and I think there is just a genuine interest in trying to make sure that some of these other loopholes are closed as well, because the 1887 law is really a mess. It's just no terms are defined very clearly, and this is an invitation to having some more shenanigans in the future. So I think that the fact that you had seven Republicans on the committee voting for it, and you have eight other co-sponsors that weren't on the committee, eight other Republicans. So you have at least 15 Republicans who have publicly indicated they're supporting this bill now in the Senate. Whereas, as you point out, in the House, the only Republicans who voted for it were the same ones who voted to impeach Donald Trump. And none of them are coming back after the elections. They've all either been defeated or have retired. And so there were really no other basis of Republican support there. So we'll see. Hopefully what will happen is the House will just basically accept the Senate version and not have to work out any other differences, because you wouldn't want to have to go back and renegotiate this in the Senate again, because there may not be time to do that in the lame duck session in December.
Talking to David Cannon, professor of American politics at UW-Madison, looking at the Electoral Count Act. Changes look likely to happen in the Senate, and the House might well follow suit then, changing the process for challenging electoral votes from states in presidential elections. Are there other changes, David, that you think should have been added or ought to be added, even if the Senate maybe wouldn't be willing to do them right now?
Well, the one thing in the House version, I don't think you mentioned the 20% versus 33% difference. I think that's fine. I mean, 20% is enough of a threshold. I'm not too worried about that. The one thing in the House version that I think would be nice to have, and I don't think the Senate's going to be willing to renegotiate this, but is they have a clearer and longer list of what exactly is meant by a failed election and a catastrophic failure. And it makes it clear that they really are talking about things like a hurricane. And so it wouldn't be anything like was claimed in 2020 would be in that category at all. And the Senate version strongly suggests that with their language, again, of an extraordinary and catastrophic event is the language they use. So it's pretty clear that that's not what was being claimed in 2020, but the House version is more detailed there, and it probably would be better to have a little more detail. But to me, that's not a big enough thing to hang this up, that's for sure.
Now, one thing that did come up after the 2020 election we had in Wisconsin and a handful of other states, some Republican electors, their electoral slate that would have been electors had their side won, signed paper saying, yeah, we're the electors. And then some supporters of the election challenge said, aha, we have two sets of electors, so we have to do something to sort that out. Do these changes prevent that from happening, or prevent that from being advanced as an argument?
Yeah, so it makes it absolutely clear that there is only one legitimate slate of electors, and that's the slate that the governor is required to submit to Congress. And that's where there's the provision that if that were to not be done in that process, and you get a rogue governor who just does something on his own without recognizing the legitimate slate of electors, then that could be challenged in the federal courts. And that process is made very clear in both the House version and the Senate version.
And I think because of that provision, Senator Cruz, who you mentioned voted against this in committee, said this is a mission creep. It's advancing federal power over states' ability to manage their elections. What do you make of that argument?
Well, so I think that argument could be leveled a little bit more at the House version than the Senate version, because the Senate version also has a provision that makes it clear that the role of the state courts will still play a role in every other aspect of enforcing an election law. And so other challenges that would come up about elections would still be litigated in state court. And it makes that clear that this is not like a federal takeover of election law. And so I think, that concern did come up when this being negotiated in the Senate. And I think they addressed that concern pretty well. So I think Ted Cruz's concerns there are really, I think, very overblown, because that provision about litigating in federal court was very clearly only involved when you have a rogue governor who is trying to illegally submit an alternative slate of electors.
So as you say, this may be passed in the lame duck session. If it isn't, I've seen some arguments from politics watchers that it, you know, if it doesn't pass before the new Congress is seated, especially if Republicans take control of one or both houses, it's very unlikely to pass at that point. Do you think that's true?
I think that's absolutely true. This definitely has to pass in December, or there's very little chance it'll go through if we do have, you know, split control in January.
If this does pass as currently written in the Senate, does it make you feel, I don't know, less nervous about the potential for a repeat of January 2021?
It absolutely does. I mean, in fact, about 10 months ago, maybe now, I was on a panel with a bunch of other election law people, and we each said, you know, what's the one thing if you could pass to, you know, for into law that would make you feel better about, like, the survival of our democracy, what would it be? And this was the one I mentioned. I said, this is the most important single thing they can do, and it should be able to get done. And so some of the other things that were talked about, you know, would be, you know, more partisan, but this is one I thought, you know, should have bipartisan support. And you know, about 10 months ago, that was the one I picked to say, yeah, this is the one that would make me sleep at night a little better.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Okay, good to be with you.
That's David Cannon, professor of American politics at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about a bipartisan effort in Congress to update the Electoral Count Act, a law that outlines the role of Congress and the vice president in certifying presidential election results. Now it's the Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Member Drive. Jill Nadeau joins me now. You rely on the Ideas Network for informative, interesting conversations. We count on you to keep programs like this one going strong.
We certainly do. Listener support is the largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio programs, and that's why your gift of any amount right now makes an important difference. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
An extra reason, an extra impact when you give right now. $25,000 is going to be released when 500 people, including you, make a gift in support of WPR programs by the end of the day today. And we are advancing steadily, I think, toward that goal.
We are. You know, at the beginning of the day, I thought, oh, we're never going to make it. And we're so close now. It is wonderful. Our listeners really came through for us. A group of generous members have created this challenge, and it's to inspire you to support the programs that you and basically our entire community rely on.
Your participation right now is a big deal. Be one of the 500 people to meet this two-day challenge before midnight arrives. Whether you've never given before or your monthly sustainer making an additional gift, your contribution is going to help us meet that goal. Join in at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
You know, in the last segment, we talked about some of the bill in Congress regarding elections, and it's so important that we understand what it says and what it will mean and what may happen to it. And you get that information and you count on that information from Central Time.
WPR's listeners supported. That means your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes the many topics you tune in for every day possible. Choose the amount that works for you and then make your gift.
And take your Wisconsin Public Radio pride on the road with your new WPR tote. It's a really bright orange and blue design, and your support of WPR programs you value will be on full display. And ask for yours with your contribution of $10 a month or more at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
I was driving along and they started talking about being ADD. And I'm ADD. I consider it a blessing now because they had talked about a book called You Mean I'm Not Lazy, Crazy, or Stupid. It pointed out things and it made things understandable for me, so it really changed my life. I'm John Ink from Wausau, Wisconsin, and I listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, and it is my source for a clear view of the world.
Make your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It's the Fall Member Drive on Central Time. Rob Ferret here with Jill Nadeau. Listener support is the largest source of funding for all the WPR programs you count on. That's why your gift of $10 a month, $100 a month, whatever amount you choose really does make a difference.
It does. And at WPR, we have a core group of supporters who continue to give and give generously, and they willingly contribute because they depend on this vital resource. Maybe you rely on WPR too, and for that reason, you haven't, and for whatever reason, rather, you haven't given yet.
Well, we're here to tell you that WPR relies on new donors, first-time donors just like you, to grow and keep high-quality programs on the air. How about making today the day? Show your support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Your gift of $5 or $10 or $20 a month, any amount that's right for you, is all it takes.
You know, it's easy to spend a dollar or more a day on things that are part of your routine, like maybe you like coffee or you have a favorite snack.
That's right. Consider the news, info, and inspiration from Wisconsin and around the world that you get every day from listening to WPR. Maybe that dollar a day, $30 a month, is just the right donation for you. Sign up right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and support the programs you enjoy every day.
And don't forget that a group of very generous members will give us $25,000. That's right, $25,000 in challenge funds when 500 people, hopefully including you, step up to support the programs that you count on.
Your gift makes an extra difference with this challenge going on. Each and every gift brings us one closer to that goal that we need to hit by midnight. And by the way, show off your support for Wisconsin Public Radio and ask for the limited edition WPR tote. It's perfect for books, groceries, your next errand. This tote will be your new favorite on-the-go accessory. It's yours when you give $10 a month or more. So think about that. You're supporting great conversations, of course. You're helping us meet this big challenge, and you get to take a tote home with you after it's all said and done. Make your gift right now, WPR.org, or call 888-202-2552.